South Central Alaska is burning. We have two active wildfires right now in populated areas. I'm Ann Hillman. On today's Talk of Alaska, we'll get updates on the Sockeye Fire and the Card Street Fire, as well as look at fires from an overall larger perspective. Stay tuned.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
This is Talk of Alaska, and today's topic is wildfires. If you want to join the conversation, the call-in number is 1-800-478-8255. Or 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling from Anchorage, it's 550-8422. You can also email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. We're going to start today's show with an overall look at fires and climate. We have a guest today, Rick Toman. He's a climate scientist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Fairbanks. Rick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Ann. Nice to be here.
Thanks. Later on, we'll be bringing on Shailen Cochran, who will have updates from the Card Street Fire, and Tom Kurth, who is with the Division of Forestry, and he is the incident commander with the Sockeye Fire. But while we're waiting to get them online, can you just give us kind of an overlook of fires in Alaska this season and then maybe in the longer term?
Well, so far, or at least up until Sunday, it had been kind of an average fire season. With a number of small fires, but there's been a comparative lack of lightning across the state so far this spring and summer, and so resources have been available to battle the fires that have started. Now, obviously, in the last 2 days, things have changed quite dramatically with the fire, the Sockeye and the Card Street fires, greatly impacting folks in the state.
And so with the smaller fires earlier this year, some of them were actually in the tundra, right?
Yeah, there were several significant fires in southwest Alaska. Not an uncommon area for these kind of fires. And, of course, with the very low snow cover this past winter in southwest Alaska, the tundra prime in that area for these early season fires.
And do you think that the low snow cover here in central Alaska has also contributed to the fires?
Well, certainly the far below normal snow cover, it impacts the long-term moisture that's in that in the surface and the subsurface area. Since snow melt occurred, precipitation over much of South Central is actually not very far from normal. But certainly the overwinter precipitation being quite low, that allows those the below the surface soils and organic matter to be unusually dry. So it's certainly a contributing factor.
And the dry soils, I guess usually when people think about fires, they don't think about this lower level material contributing to it.
Well, certainly that subsurface material, that can contribute to the intensity and the longevity of those fires. Obviously, what's first burning is going to be, in general, is above the surface, unless you're talking about, say, a coal seam fire or something like that. But those dry subsoils, for instance, that's a reason that sometimes we'll see intense fires over winter and come to life the following spring when that fire gets down into that subsurface layer and can persist all winter.
Wow. We now have on the line, we have Shailen Cochran calling in from Kenai. He's a reporter down at KDLL. Shailen, what is going on with Card Street Fire?
Well, good morning, Ann, and thanks for having me on. The Card Street Fire at this point has grown to about 1,200 acres. It actually slowed down quite a little bit last night, some favorable winds helping to slow the growth of that fire in the evening hours. The big news going into today is that we're finally getting some relief in terms of personnel. Five hotshot crews, so about 100 firefighters, are expected into Kenai this evening to help with the Card Street Fire. And that fire is happening in Sterling. So folks familiar with the peninsula, Sterling is between Cooper Landing and Soldotna down here on the Kenai Peninsula.
And so in Sterling, how many resources are at risk, I suppose? How many houses, how many other types of structures?
Hundreds and hundreds. Now, this fire is, in terms of where a fire goes, we're kind of lucky because on the east end, the fire is bordered by Skelak Lake, which is a very big lake, the Kenai River to the south, and the Sterling Highway to the north. And so right now, local crews from the Kenai Peninsula Borough and Central Emergency Services down here are focusing a lot of their efforts on the west end of that, where there are a lot of homes, a lot of property in the line of danger right now. To this point, only a half a dozen structures have been confirmed taken out by this fire, but we'll see as this thing goes on through the end of the day. Forestry officials are expecting another hot, dry, potentially windy day, and the forecast looks like lightning, and I believe we've got a cut lined up. I just spoke before we got on air here for Talk of Alaska. I spoke with Division of Forestry spokesperson Terry Anderson, who had some things to say about the lightning forecast that's predicted for tonight on the Kenai Peninsula.
The thing that concerns us today is a lightning forecast for the Kenai Peninsula. You might see some large clouds building up. That can cause erratic winds and thunderstorms late in the evening. That's the forecast for our area today. The national lightning forecast for dry lightning, which firefighters always go over in the weather forecast in the mornings, it's a lightning forecast from 1 to 6. Usually in Alaska, you may see twos or threes or fours for a lightning forecast. The forecast for the Kenai is at a 6 today. That's about as high as it gets.
So as we hear there, not just the dry and potentially windy conditions, but also lightning, possibly a threat to add to this fire as well today for crews.
With all of that in mind, I mean, what's the plan of action? Have they described sort of what people need to be doing and what the crews will be doing?
Sure, absolutely. Voluntary evacuations, in fact, strongly urged evacuations have been taking place since about 7 o'clock Monday evening. No word on exactly how many folks have evacuated that area. The evacuation area did grow in size quite a little bit overnight. And again, there are about 5,000 people who live in the Sterling area, which is a very large area. But here we're talking about this, again, roughly 1,200 acres or so, right along the Kenai River, the Kenai Keys area. And there are a lot of homes in that area, a lot of second homes, a lot of, you know, old homesteader cabins, countless outbuildings, outhouses. I mean, you name it. There's a pretty fair amount of development in this area, and a lot of property to be concerned about, and that fire crews are working really hard to save right now.
All right. And again, my name is Ann Hillman. This is Talk of Alaska, and we're talking to Shailen Cochran, who is down on the Kenai, about the Card Street Fire. You mentioned earlier that you will be getting more resources there. How many people are you expecting? Why has it taken so long to get resources to the area?
Well, no word on, mostly just travel time. Of course, we know that there's a lot of action going on in Willow today, so there are a lot of resources up there. A hotshot crew, again, has been called in, and they're going to be in Kenai tonight to assist in this fire in Sterling. That's 100 extra firefighters. So far, the response on the ground has been with almost entirely local supports from the Kenai Peninsula Borough. So fire departments from Nikiski all the way down to Kachemak Bay down in Homer have come up and to help respond to this. There have been numerous passes over, I think somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 or 40 passes with fire retardant material has been dumped on the area. Yesterday, throughout the day, a couple of helicopters made numerous trips to the Kenai River to dip out water. and try to keep some of these areas in check. And in fact, there are a couple of areas south of the Kenai River that have firefighters staged there where there's, you know, maybe a half an acre to an acre or so of space where this fire has jumped the river. And they feel pretty confident that those areas south of the Kenai River are contained and are in check. And so, again, focusing today as we wait for more hotshot crews to show up on the scene, the local crews are focusing all their attention on the west end of this fire as it pushes around. And again, in terms of what direction it's actually going, it's hard to tell right now. The wind right now isn't terribly strong, and overnight that wind kind of died down and helped keep this fire in check a little bit. But they're kind of just preparing for anything that the weather might be able to throw at them today.
And you said it jumped the river. Do you have any sense of how typical that is, if that will be a problem?
Typical for right now, because we're looking at largely spruce as fuel for this fire, and almost immediately when this fire started, the fire raced up to the top of those spruce trees, which again we all know are very, very dry right now, and that makes it pretty easy to jump greater distances as this fire moves less on the ground and more at the top of the trees. And so there's actually even in the Kenai River, there's a little island that there's some trees on that, and they have a couple firefighters on that island in the middle of the Kenai River that is they've had a couple spots flare up there. So this fire is jumping around a little bit, but again, the word I get from forestry officials is that they have people on those spots that are growing away from the main area and feel confident that they're able to keep those little spots in check right now.
All right. Are they digging fire lines at all? Is that part of the strategy?
Fire lines have been part of the strategy, and a lot of really just, as far as I know, a lot of just hosing things down and waiting for the cavalry to arrive at this point. We're kind of lucky in that this area, because there are a lot of homes, it is fairly well developed, and so the infrastructure is there in terms of roads and access points to bring in heavy equipment if that's going to be needed at some point, lots of staging areas, and I haven't been out that way yet today. But I know that that area of the Sterling Highway was very, very, very busy with fire trucks, heavy equipment, Alaska State Troopers trying to keep the road clear and keep everyone safe out there. So there's a lot of action going on right now. And again, waiting for about 100 hotshot crew members to show up tonight to help control this.
All right. And is the Sterling Highway open for all traffic?
The Sterling Highway is open right now, yes.
Okay. And another quick update regarding the other highway in question, the Parks Highway. There are pilot cars that are escorting traffic through between miles 88 and 66. Conditions are smoky. And the opening of the highway is subject to change if the fire acts up. That's an update on the Sockeye fire coming from Philip Manning, who's the news producer up at KTNA. So again, there's through traffic only up on the Parks Highway. It sounds like there's through traffic down in the Sterling Highway. Rick, let's switch over to you. Shailen talked a lot about lightning and the impact of lightning. Is there typically a lot of lightning at this stage in the game in Alaska?
We're into now the climatological peak of the lightning season. For about the next 6 weeks or so is when Alaska gets nearly all of its lightning, especially in the fire-prone areas. Not at all unusual.
All right. When people talk a lot about weather, everyone always mentions things like El Niño or La Niña. Does that factor into the weather patterns that we're seeing now and during fire season?
Well, it turns out that when we have significant El Niños, which of course are defined as unusually warm water near the equator in the Pacific Ocean, kind of south and southeast of Hawaii, it turns out when we have those waters unusually warm, over parts of interior Alaska, there actually is a increased likelihood for dry summers. And, of course, dry summers a contributing factor, especially to the big fire seasons.
All right. Again, your listeners, you're listening to Talk of Alaska Statewide. We'd like to hear your stories of how these fires and fires of the past have impacted you. Call us at 1-800-478-8255. 8255, or in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. You can also email us at talkofalaska@alaskapublic.org. So, Shailen, are there other things that people should know at this point about the Card Street fire?
We can kind of trace it back. I'd like to, we're getting a sense of how this fire has developed, and I'd like to share that. Really what happened yesterday afternoon, Monday afternoon, somewhere around 1:30 or so, this fire was called in. Crews responded relatively short order by 2 o'clock. What was being reported was approximately a 1-acre grass fire. However, it was in an area that was accessible only by four-wheelers. So really what we had happen was a fire that we couldn't get proper apparatus to until it grew sufficiently to get to places where you could actually get fire trucks and hoses and things to it. And by that time, you know, winds had picked up and the day had grown on, and then it just kind of got away from folks. So right now what's going on is there are evacuation centers open. The Sterling Community Center has been a real hub and a real hotbed of activity. They were up bright and early this morning serving breakfast to folks. I know that there weren't any people who spent the night at the Sterling Community Center. I know that some hotels in Soldotna took some folks in. The Sterling Community Center did take in some domestic pets last night. We know that. But for the most part, people were able to find places to stay with family and friends. There's been, as I've followed throughout the day on social media, the offers are pouring in from Kenai, Soldotna, and Nikiski, all over the Central Peninsula to help out with this. Everything from donating food and clothes to offering up, you know, horse trailers to move livestock and things like that. Because again, we're talking about an area that's pretty wide open and has a lot of folks there, but a lot of folks that have dogs, horses, chickens, all those sorts of things that need to be taken into consideration when you're talking about evacuating a big area.
That sounds great. That actually reminds me a lot of when we covered the Funny River fire last year. It was a big community outpouring of making sure that everyone was taken care of. Thank you so much for all of the updates, Shailen. We actually now have Tom Kurth on the line. He is the incident commander for the Sockeye fire. Tom, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ann. I understand that we were going to have an hour-long program until the activity started there, so I'd like to do that sometime when we get an opportunity.
I would love that at some very much more calm point. Tell me what's going on up in Willow now.
Okay, well, the Type 1 team, which is a group of subject experts in wildland firefighting, such as logistics and air ops and operations, finance, planning, that sort of thing. We're just transitioning with the initial attack forces that have been there, and for the last 48 to 72 hours here, they've done all the initial work here to help protect structures and keep the highway open, keep the railroad moving, that sort of thing. So we're supplementing their force, giving them some relief from the fatigue of firefighting. They've been at it for a long time here. And so we're transitioning out today, shadowing with their folks that have been on the fire line here, and we'll be picking up where they have left off and then incorporating some of them into our operation.
So what exactly does it mean to be a Type 1 fire?
Well, we have various levels of complexity, anything from a 1 through 5. And as it goes up, ascending to the 1 level, those are our most complex fires. And so typically we have urban interface, various stakeholders involved, local fire departments, and more complexity such as geography with logistics or air operations and those activities. And so we have our most experienced firefighters assembled with a team like that to take over these complex incidents. And then we're also on a national rotation to respond to fires in the lower 48. So it's just a level of complexity that's involved there. Most often our Alaskan fires are either type 4, which is our simplest level, or type 3, which, you know, maybe 100, 150 people, to a type 2, where we might have 500 individuals. And then when we get to the type 1, we're up there, you know, well above 500, or, you know, just as I was saying, a numerous mix of items such as aircraft and helicopters, National Guard, local fire departments, that sort of thing.
So you have 500 people responding to this fire?
Well, we have. Well, we're only at the 200 level right now, but as I hear for the Kenai fires, we have. We have five Type 1 crews coming in today, and we'll have additional aircraft. We're supplementing our air resources with two additional Convair 580s, our retardant-dropping aircraft. They'll be in today from Canada, and so this level will be stepping up as we progress through the week here.
So tell me about how the fire is behaving. What's requiring this massive step up?
Well, the original fire made some extreme runs there. It finds this black spruce and runs pretty hot there. It can, I think the first day there was at least a 7-mile run, so that lets you know how this fire can grow. And it, finds the fuel, the weather, and the topography to move it. And, we've had some fortunate weather conditions, at least for the last 12 hours or so, from the standpoint of the fire has not moved, but we're expecting more extreme conditions today. Thunderstorms are predicted here, dry lightning. You get, erratic or unpredictable winds that are associated with those thunderstorms. And so, we're anticipating at least some more fire activity today. And as far as our weather forecast goes, no break in sight for the hot, dry weather here.
Mm-hmm. Does the rain that usually comes with a thunderstorm negate the lightning at all? Does it do anything positive?
Well, that's a function of the cloud height there. So these are high bases, and if you get any rain out of them, it tends to evaporate even before it reaches the ground here. So there is no rain predicted with any storms that we might see today, and they're supposed to be centraled over the Talkeetna Mountains, which are directly to the east here.
Okay. Centered.
One thing I did want to say is I hear you talking about lightning-caused fires. The majority of our fires for the Division of Forestry are human-caused. Our busiest month tends to be May, and then our largest month as far as acres go tends to be June. But, these fires have been human-caused, and, we're trying to exercise caution and remind the public that, we have restricted open burning, and, we need any sort of ignition point represents a problem with the current fuel conditions that we have out there.
And that has been made very clear all throughout Anchorage as well, that it's a very risky time. Does the cause of the fire impacted all the behavior of the fire or simply where it starts?
Well, every wildland fire really starts with a single spark, whether it be a lightning strike or, somebody sharpening a shovel or leaving a campfire or fireworks or anything like that. That's all it takes. And then they pick up momentum, they go undetected. So initial attack is our best weapon right now for keeping fires at a smaller acreage. But if these go undetected for a while and they have the conditions, our problematic fires nowadays, such as our fire down there in Kenai, they start early in the day, and so they have these long burning periods with the sun shining on them. Mm. And you're looking at about a 20-hour burning period just with the intensity of the sunlight here. So these fires have plenty of time to pick up momentum.
And can you confirm that this fire was human caused? Do you know what the cause of the Sockeye fire is?
Well, certainly the fire is what we suspect is human caused. It's under investigation and we don't have those details right now, but we do have lightning detection system that triangulates each and every strike out there. So as your forecaster that's there can tell you, we're monitoring each and every lightning strike. Some are dry, some are wet. You might get 5,000 strikes in a day, 7,000 strikes. It's possible to get a lot of lightning strikes in a state with this much geography.
Mm-hmm. So can you tell me a little bit of, you mentioned earlier that there's going to be planes coming up and there'll be fire retardants. How effective are fire retardants on this type of fire?
Okay, I missed some of that question there, but you were asking about the effectiveness of fire retardants?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we have a variety of retardant aircraft up here. There's even two new next generation air tankers that are called here with carry as much as 3,000 gallons. There are four engine jets out there that can deliver 3,000 gallons to us. Our Convairs have 2,000 gallons. There's two of those, another two coming up. We do have one water scooping aircraft, more affectionately known as a duck, that's out there. You know, they can scoop anywhere from 8 to 1,200 gallons. And then we have these single engine air tankers that the Alaska Fire Service has that are capable of scooping about 800 gallons. And so depending on your fuel type, and your fire intensity determines how they lay that retardant out. You know, they can put what's called gates out there, some like two gates, four gates, something like that, depending on what they need out there to try and knock the momentum out of, you know, a running crown fire or similar with that. So that's oftentimes our first line of defense to get us an anchor point and lay down that sort of, you know, fire line, fire retardant line, and then we back it up with personnel to follow up behind there to try and hold and contain that. So it depends on what kind of fire you have and what kind of intensity you have when you're doing retardant drops.
Is that the strategy that you're using on this fire?
Once again, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
What are the strategies you are using for this particular fire?
Well, the strategies are determined by the agency themselves. So the Division of Forestry is who we are working for as an interagency team. Now, this fire, since it has high resource values, we have numerous structures out there, somewhere around the 1800 mark. And so our strategy is really is to protect those structures first and then minimize the acreage out there. So when we get an opportunity to go direct and put fire line directly along the edge there and try and contain this fire at the minimum size. Now, you're going to use roads and natural barriers and railroads and whatever we can get a hold of, and then we might connect it together with heavy equipment like a dozer or something like that. So we'll try and use all those strategies to eventually get a line around it, all while we're trying to individually protect structures out there. So there's a lot of structures that are contained within the fire line here. So as it was described this morning, it's like firefighting inside out to try and protect those structures and then go out and also contain the fire from encroaching on any other values out there.
How dangerous is this fire for the people who are fighting it?
Well, you know, we're staffing up, and one of the reasons we use Type 1 crews...
Suspected, but not...
There are most experienced crews out there, so they can operate much more independently than some of our other crews. And so, you know, they're at least attuned to extreme firefighting conditions, you know, and a fire like this can surprise you. They lay low until it gets hotter and drier, and then something pops up. And, you know, every one of those fires that come up like that, they can go up into the spruce trees, and then they do this sort of candling out there, and they spot all over the place. And then instead of just one little fire, now all of a sudden you're fighting 10 fires, and those, you know, kind of catch another tree on fire until it's kind of expanding logarithmically there. And so there's all sorts of, it can expand very fast out there. Then these black spruce fires spot ahead of themselves, 100 feet, 200 feet, maybe up to a quarter of a mile. So they're throwing sparks out there, and then they come back at you as the fire draws additional fire into it. So that's how the black spruce fires can expand rapidly there. So, I mean, you got to be careful about being out at the head of these fires at any time.
And what are the most important things at this stage for community members to know?
Well, community members are on a voluntary evacuation. It's a fairly large area through this willow section here. The borough has been coordinating that. There is an evacuation center there at the Houston High School area. We've hopefully gotten folks out. and all their pets and all their valuables and that sort of thing. And everybody's been very cooperative. And now, you know, we're going to keep people from going back in here for at least, you know, another 24, 48 hours. I really can't predict that without seeing what we have for fire behavior, because there is plenty of fire active interior-wise and around these structures. And so, you know, it's an inconvenience to all the residents here whenever we do these evacuations and folks are desperate to get back to see if they have a home or if they, some need their tools or, you know, to keep their present-day lives going. So, you know, that's a big inconvenience to the public, and we're trying to, you know, mitigate that right now. But so far, the state troopers have the access blocked off and are not allowing people back in there, and we're working with the borough to coordinate that, and we'll see what it takes to get people back, probably in a guarded situation there eventually here. But as it stands right now, no one's entering back in the area.
Because even though the fire has burned through, there's still danger spots within the area.
Well, as the day progresses here and it gets hotter and drier and the winds pick up, the thunderstorms occur, out comes these hot spots, you know, and what you thought was a quiet, dormant area can certainly become rather active. And, you know, you'll see as these trees pick up, you get a 30, 40-foot flame front coming through there again. So this incident is by no means stable at this point.
Is any portion of the fire considered contained?
Well, we have some heavy equipment that's established line on the north side, which is our anchor point. This fire has been progressing from the north to the south. And so that area there has been, we haven't had any perimeter move on us up there in 24 hours. However, they say that this fire can even back and gain acreage in it. So that's called a backing fire, and it kind of, you know, creeps in the opposite direction of the wind. And we still have that activity at that end. We've been holding what perimeter we have, but by no means, again, is it contained.
All right. Before we go to a quick break, I do have a person has called in with a question, hoping that you can discuss the effects of fireworks on dry forest, especially since the 4th of July is coming up and there will be a danger.
Oh, yeah. Well, the state fire marshal's office has the regulatory control over fireworks sales and fireworks use. But we, as the Division of Forestry, have always discouraged the use of fireworks in the summertime, you know, for our reasons. That is, again, one spark is all it takes to start a wildland fire, and there's plenty of receptive fuels out there. So you send a bottle rocket or, you know, a firecracker or something into those woods, you'll find that it will start a fire that you cannot run down single-handedly. So no fireworks is what the Division of Forestry would tell people. There's plenty of opportunity in the wintertime. It's the right environment. Even the night setting is a little more spectacular for those investments. So we'll discourage any use of fireworks. And it doesn't matter if it's fireworks or sharpening a shovel or using an ATV or laying a chainsaw down. Those are how these person-caused fires get started nowadays.
Wow. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back on Talk of Alaska Statewide. Stay with us.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Talk of Alaska Statewide on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Ann Hillman, and today's topic is wildfires. If you have any comments or questions, you can call us at 1-800-478-8255, or if you're in Anchorage, it's 550-8422. And we have Tom Kurth on the line. Tom, can you stay with us for any longer?
I can. We'll be ready to move, though, as soon as you're done with me.
All right. Where are you moving off to?
Well, we're at the north end of the fire. We just need to get back through the fire area here and back to organization and meeting with the borough here. So we're just getting started with our organization. So I can sense the phone calls piling up.
All right. What else do you think it's very important for people to know at this stage of the game? And then please go. We don't want to keep you.
Well, I mean, we always give our FireWise message about making sure that your home is defendable. That means taking the combustible materials away from your house when you're given the opportunity. You know, no firewood piled up against it, no burnable dead grass and all that. And that helps firefighters if they actually have to defend your home. We already talked about, human-caused fires and trying to at least minimize that problem out there. And certainly we appreciate the public's cooperation here in reporting fires and early detection. So they're a big part of this. I mean, Alaska is definitely wildland fire country, and, we consider all the public part of our firefighting force here. We do have the Parks Highway is open with restrictions. That means we're doing pilot car traffic through that mile. I think you said 66 through 80 or somewhere around in there. So expect delays when you're coming through there. We do have the railroad moving. And I think other than that, we should be good unless you have some specific questions before we go.
No, thank you so much for being on and for providing all of this information.
Okay. Thank you for the opportunity. And again, we'll try and spend some time when we get longer because we'd like to talk about the well and fire program in general.
All right. Thank you. I do have one. Actually, we have a quick question from a caller. You up for it? Is it possible to permanently shut down fireworks stands at the Big Lake Junction?
Well, when I went by them yesterday, I didn't see any of them open. And as I said, that's a fire marshal call. We have already shut down open burning with our burn permit restrictions. The fire marshal certainly waits for our word as far as what conditions are, and our wildland fire conditions are extreme. We have had an extremely dry May, working all the way into this June here. I think we just had relief with one precipitation event there for about a week or something like that. So many of our firefighters who have a lot of experience are certainly impressed with the dry conditions here. And we are exhibiting or at least encouraging caution in our wildland firefighting force. So certainly that message has to get to the public.
All right. Thank you again. And we all wish you very well.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Again, this is Talk of Alaska, and we are focusing on wildfires. We currently have two wildfires burning in south central Alaska, the Card Street Fire down in Sterling on the Kenai Peninsula, as well as the Sockeye Fire up near Willow, north of Anchorage, south of Fairbanks. If you have any stories you'd like to share from these fires or fires of the past, please do call in. The number is 1-800-478-TALK, or you can email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. Also on the line, we still have Rick Toman, who is up with NOAA in Fairbanks. Rick, thanks for being so patient as we get some of these fire updates.
Okay, and that's what we need to know.
So the running theme seems to be dry conditions. They're very, very dry conditions. Is this, some studies say that this is the new normal, long, hot, dry. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, certainly across mainland Alaska, we're seeing in particular warmer springs in the last 15 years or so. And this is having the effect of lengthening that fire season in many places around mainland Alaska. Again, the primary fire areas, say from the Kenai Peninsula through South Central and into the interior, half or more of the Mays since, say, 2004 have been in that significantly warmer than normal category. And many places have had a number of their warmest Mays ever. In some places, climate observations go back a century. And four or five, at Talkeetna, seven of the warmest Mays of record have been since 2000. So we're definitely seeing a trend towards warmer springs, earlier snowmelt, and that's just lengthening the season for fire potential.
This may seem like a bit of a silly question, but Tom talked a lot about the sunshine and the hot sun really contributing to fires growing. Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. During the day, of course, all other things being equal, when the sun's shining, the temperature goes up, and that lowers the relative humidity. And as that relative humidity gets quite low, that, of course, encourages fire behavior. Yesterday afternoon, for instance, at Talkeetna, relative humidity got down to 11%, and that is extremely dry. And when you have very flammable fuels like black spruce, dried grasses, that's a prime ingredient for these the fire growth.
And so we're experiencing this up in Alaska. Are other northern areas having similar climatic changes?
Well, we're certainly seeing changes in the lower 48 in western Canada. Alaska is a little different than, say, the lower 48 in the fire season in that the overwinter precipitation and the amount of snow certainly has an impact on the early season fires. But if you look at the total acreage burned in Alaska each season, there's actually very little correlation with the previous winter's snowfall. And that's because fires in Alaska are very dependent on the weather during that warm season. That's quite different than in the lower 48 in the West, where fire season overall is much more tied to the overwinter precipitation and the snowpack. Not completely, of course, but it's a much tighter fit than we see in Alaska, which is very dependent on the weather, the day-to-day weather that we get during the warm season.
Are fires in Alaska tied at all to terrain type as well?
Certainly, the areas that have the most volatile fuels, as Tom was talking about, black spruce, our favorite areas, but of course you can get, and as we've seen, we can get tundra fires both in southwest Alaska, and of course in recent years we've seen big fires on the North Slope as well. So unless you're in hard rock and you're not on a coal seam, almost any environment in Alaska has the potential to burn.
Why is it that fires on the North Slope are atypical?
Well, of course, it's typically much cooler north of the Brooks Range, and there aren't the trees to burn. Historically, they have occurred. The Anituvik River fire a few years ago was certainly amongst the largest wildfires on the slope of record, and even looking at things like fire scars from satellite imagery, it appears to be a very unusual fire. We are concerned that as the North Slope continues to warm, which it certainly has in the last 50 years, that those kind of fires are likely to increase in frequency.
We talk a lot about how climate change is increasing fires and changing fire frequency. Do fires in turn contribute to climate change?
I think we could say that on the local scale, they can influence your climate and weather. To the extent that they can affect the whole global climate system would be another matter. Certainly, as we saw a few years ago with large areas of Siberia, for instance, burning, certainly puts a lot of particulates into the air. But in general, those tend to be pretty low elevation, at least from the climate system side. So they tend to come out pretty quickly. So overall, we probably say it's probably not a large enough scale to affect the entire global climate system.
Okay. I had been reading some of the research reports that said that the fires are releasing all of these carbons. And so it's basically what were carbon sinks in Alaska are now in reverse because the carbon is loose. Or is there any validity to that idea?
Well, certainly, when you burn up plant matter, you're releasing carbon. Potentially, the longer-term impacts include you have a fire go through, then you open up that area. You start to thaw permafrost in parts of Alaska where that's present, and the carbon that's in there then starts to decay. So it's all a potential feedback. Again, on the climate scale, it's relatively small, obviously very important for Alaskans.
All right. And we have a caller on the line, Sonia, calling in from Eagle. Please, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi. I'd just like to voice what I know is on a lot of our minds and say thank you to all the firefighters that are putting themselves, you know, right there to protect our things year after year and our lives, and they're putting their lives on the line. My little sister has been a hotshot for, I believe, 12 years now, and every time a big fire like this happens, I can't reach her on her cell. It just goes to automatic answer, and my thoughts are always with her. And as she leads her crew, I just wish them all the safety and luck that they could have, and all the thanks from us. Heartfelt thanks for the 04 and 05 fire times when they helped to save Eagle. Heartfelt thanks for the big fire they were on recently near here from everybody, and especially from me.
Thank you so much. I think you're right. That is an idea that many people are focusing on these days.
Yeah, and I know these young people, they're amazing. They're not all young, but they're all amazing. And it's just, I think in my mind, they're probably what I would consider heroes because they do their job so efficiently and they are so careful. They try to do such a good job, and I just encourage people to say thanks if they see him around.
Thank you so much for calling in.
Yep, bye.
Bye. We also have on the line Philip, who is up in Talkeetna with KTNA. Philip Manning, are you seeing an outpouring of community support for the firefighters?
We don't have as many of the firefighters stationing out of this area, and a lot of them are basing out of, when we spoke to Tom Kurth, they're setting up a little bit further down the highway from us, potentially down by like the Sheep Creek Lodge area. What we are seeing is community outreach and support for the folks who are they were displaced, and there has been a lot of help. I know the Matsu Borough sent out a message thanking My House for helping out with food for the firefighters, and so there has been a lot of community support, and a lot of folks at this point are asking, you know, how can they help? What we're hearing is donations for the shelters are being coordinated through the Red Cross, and then there's a number at the State Emergency Operations Center where they can tell people what items are needed by the people who are being displaced as those needs arise.
And do you have those numbers offhand?
I do. I have them here in front of me. The number for the Red Cross is 357-6060. And then the number for the State Emergency Operations Center is 428-7146. And those are available on the Matanuska Susitna Borough's Facebook page is where I found them.
All right. Thank you very much, Philip. We're going to take a quick break and then come back and hopefully take more calls from listeners about wildfires in Alaska. Stay tuned.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Alaska Pacific University offers a distinctive, personalized education grounded in hands-on, real-world experience that prepares graduates to be contributing members and leaders in their communities. This message sponsored by APU.
Garrison Keillor, one of the most beloved radio hosts and acclaimed humorists, is coming to the Alaska State Fair with his America the Beautiful Tour on Sunday, August 30th at 3 p.m. This 2.5-hour show will feature Prairie Home Companion classics with piano master Richard Dworsky, sound effects man Fred Newman, and other special guests. Tickets at alaskastatefair.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska Statewide. Today we're talking about wildfires and would love to hear about your experiences through fires that are happening right now and fires of the past. You can give us a call at 1-800-478-8255 or email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. On the line from Fairbanks, we have Rick Toman, who is with NOAA and can talk a lot about climate issues. And how climate is affecting fire. Rick, when I was preparing for the show, I read a lot of things about how the fire season is getting longer, it's getting worse. And a listener emailed in and said that around Fairbanks, he's like, no, there's been fewer fires and things aren't getting worse. What should people be listening to?
Well, I think, Anne, that the numbers kind of speak for themselves. If we look, again, now we're looking statewide, from the early 1940s and up through 1987, there were 9 seasons that exceeded 1 million acres burned in the state. Since 1988, up through last year, there's been 11 years with more than 1 million acres burned. So there's been about a doubling of the frequency of those relatively big fire seasons. And certainly most of the biggest fire seasons have been in the last 20 years.
So a doubling of the acreage. I hear 1 million acres and it's a quantity so large I can't really get my mind around it. Are people likely to see evidence of all of these fires?
Well, certainly, as you drive around Alaska, you keep your eyes open, and not too hard to see evidence of past fires, whether it's a standing burn spruce or large fields of fireweed, often indicative of past fires.
Can you talk much about whether areas that have burned in the past are likely to burn again?
Well, obviously, an area that has just burned, say, in the last year, is going to have less fuels available for future fires until the vegetation grows back. But it's actually surprising to me as a climate scientist how quickly areas that burn. It only takes a few years until there's enough shrub growth returns to actually sustain fires. And we've seen that several times in recent years on the Tanana Flats south of Fairbanks, where areas that had burned just a few years before burned again.
Wow. A listener has written in, and she says, please mention that even lawn clippings left in the sun can heat up, smolder, and burst into flames. Her daughter in Kenai had that almost happen yesterday in their yard. I'd never even thought of that being possible. Have you heard much about things like that?
Well, certainly any dried vegetation has the potential to burn. And we're at the time of year, of course, with long days and the maximum solar heating. So, if it's vegetation and it's dry, it could burn.
Another issue that has been brought up are spruce beetle-killed spruce trees. Do those pose more of a risk for certain areas?
Well, certainly dried vegetation, for instance, a dead spruce tree killed by spruce beetles, is going to be as or more flammable than green vegetation. So areas that were very hard hit by the spruce beetle kill, it ups the fire threat and the potential for fire growth yet another notch over if those stands were living and healthy.
Does the fact that a dead tree, you know how they eventually they lose their leaves or their needles and whatnot, and they become much more sparse. Does that actually end up providing less fuels because it's harder to make these giant crown fires that can jump from place to place?
Well, my understanding is as those trees, they're dead and they dry out, they would actually become, more flammable than a live tree. Now, of course, if they're dead and they burn, then that will be replaced by something. For instance, areas on the Kenai Peninsula that burned a number of years ago, we're seeing grasslands repopulate those areas as opposed to, at this point at least, spruce forest spreading back.
All right. At this point in the fire season, what else do you think community members need to know?
Well, I think probably the most important thing, as has been vividly demonstrated to Alaskans in the last 2 days, many parts of the state that are subject to fire had a relatively or quite low snowpack, and that's contributed to that dry duff layer, as we've talked about. We're only, a third of the way through really the peak of the fire season here in Alaska. We are somewhat fortunate compared to the lower 48, where by the time we get to August, if there aren't big fires burning, the threat starts to diminish fairly significantly. But we're a long way from August yet. So as Tom was mentioning, we want to be careful out there. It only takes a single spark. And areas that are quite dry, there's always the potential for very rapid development, as we've seen the last 2 days.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Rick Thoman from Fairbanks, from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. We also had Philip Manning on the line from Talkeetna. Shailen Cochran was on the line from down in Kenai. And earlier we had Tom Kurth, who is up and in charge of the Sockeye Fire near Willow. Thank you, everyone who called in or wrote in. Remember, it is fire season. Conditions are hot. Conditions are dry. There are fire burns in many places. Thanks for tuning in. This is Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the Promise Tuition Grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.